From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Jane Clayson. This is Here and Now. Today is the first day of school in most public school districts in Florida, and teachers across the state are struggling with how to comply with the state's new parental rights in education law, which critics call the Don't Say Gay law. It went into effect July 1st. The law restricts classroom instruction on sexual orientation and gender identity for students through third grade, but it's also causing confusion over what books teachers can use and whether being open about their identity could get them fired. Andrew Spahr is president of the Florida Education Association. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me.
Well, there's been a lot of confusion over what this law actually means, and some teachers accuse the state of being vague about it on purpose. What are you hearing from teachers today about how they're approaching this new school year?
Well, teachers are very concerned. They're not sure what to make of all of these new laws. It's actually increasing the amount of work. In fact, we even have crazy things happening where school districts are telling teachers that they need to go through every book in their classroom, or they're not allowed to have scholastic book fairs anymore, or take donations of books. And you want a diverse set of books, a diverse viewpoint of books, so that any child can pick up a book and go, hey, I can relate to that book. That's me. I see me in that book, because we want to excite their reading. We have an ethical and moral responsibility to make sure that kids are getting the education they deserve. And our advice right now is stay the course. Do what you know is best for kids.
Well, is that confusing for teachers? I mean, are teachers scrambling to figure out how to actually follow these rules? And with Floridians newly empowered to sue school boards over these new measures, are teachers and school administrators worried about that?
I think school administrators are. I think teachers are as well, obviously, because someone who doesn't even have a kid in the school can object to something that teachers are teaching. In fact, a teacher yesterday reported that they got a public records request from someone who has no kids in the school system, no kids in his class, but because he's been an outspoken critic of what's going on here in Florida, and he's a social studies and history teacher, someone outside in the community is demanding to see his syllabus and what he's going to teach. That just takes things to another level. You know, the number one issue in the state of Florida right now is actually that we have a massive teacher and staff shortage, and we should be focusing on that. Instead, we're having to focus on things that are based on false pretenses and lies.
The State Department of Education says that this new law does not ban discussion of sexual orientation or gender identity as long as it is, quote, developmentally appropriate. But the state has not clearly defined what developmentally appropriate actually means. What kind of clarity would you like from state education officials for teachers in the classroom?
Again, I think I'm going to go back to this is intentionally meant to create chaos and confusion. When you propose legislation, as our governor did in regards to gender identity, sexual orientation, he said it's being taught in grades K through 3, and it's not. It never has been. So it's basing all of this on a false pretense for political purposes. The governor has now gotten involved in school board elections. He's encouraged political parties to get involved in school board elections. He's politicizing school boards. I don't know that we will ever get clarity from the Department of Education here in the state of Florida. They've adopted no rules around this stuff, and I don't think they intend to. I think it's intentional to have this confusion and chaos.
Beyond teachers now having to go through every book, being told there are no more book fairs, teachers in Palm Beach County were reportedly ordered to hide some books in a classroom closet. What are you hearing about these measures to actually comply with this new law?
Yeah, I think we're seeing an overreaction because we don't know what we're supposed to do in a lot of district when it comes to what to do with books in the classroom. We're seeing, again, people very often who have no kids in the school system wanting to ban books in our schools. This idea of banning books is not American. It's really taking us away from the core mission of what we need to do in education, which is make sure that every child gets that education they deserve and need.
The DeSantis administration has told school districts to ignore advice from the federal government that guarantees civil rights protections for LGBTQ students. They've also suggested teachers downplay the historical separation of church and state. The LGBTQ advocacy group Equity Florida is suing the state over this law. What are you watching for next?
Well, you know, there's several lawsuits going on in Florida. My hope is that we get back to some sanity. And I don't think we should wait on rulings from the courts. We have elections going on right now. And what we're encouraging everyone to do is really focus on what matters. If we don't have bus drivers to get kids to school on time, kids are missing out on the education. If kids don't have teachers in the classroom, or they're in classes that have been doubled up, or they're in classes that are overcrowded, they're missing out on the education they deserve and need, and the Florida Constitution requires. So what we're saying is ask everyone running for office, what are you doing to address the teacher and staff shortage? And if they're not talking about funding and pay and supporting teachers and staff, if they're not talking about lifting up the profession, don't vote for them. That's what we should focus on.
Andrew Spahr is president of the Florida Education Association. Andrew, thank you very much for your time today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Well, staying with schools, but this time colleges, and a conversation maybe for older ears, campuses across the country are adding a new selection to vending machines as students push for more access to Plan B, the emergency contraceptive pill, to increase reproductive health options in the wake of the Supreme Court decision overturning Roe v. Wade. Plan B is not an abortion. It doesn't end pregnancies. It prevents them from happening, prevents ovulation and egg fertilization when taken within 72 hours after unprotected sex. Alexandra Nieto is a member of Northeastern University's Sexual Health Advocacy Resources and Education Group, or SHARE. They are advocating for a Plan B vending machine. Alexandra, why?
This conversation has been up in the works with SHARE for a couple months now. And with the overturn of Roe v. Wade recently, we decided to kind of up our efforts and really put all of our eggs in one basket and really push for this machine on campus.
I'm going to ignore the all eggs in one basket. and you were laughing, but in parts of the country, there are going to be parents in particular cringing at this. My student at school might be able to access through a vending machine something that I won't know anything about and won't have any opportunity to help them with. Why do you think that these pills should be available through a vending machine?
That's a great question. To have this access to pills, students are able to make that decision on their own and do it without any barriers to it. And students are in college. We are participating in hookup culture, and we have to be safe about it.
Well, and, you know, Northeastern is here in Massachusetts, where the Republican governor, Charlie Baker, is specifically allowing vending machines. What is your concern?
The concern right now is getting it kind of implemented on campus. We have not yet had that opportunity to work with upper administration right now. There has been some lack of communication. So just some red tape is our worries right now. By having this potentially in our library, which is available to students 24/7, having that access, it really destigmatizes it and lets students know that it's not something to be ashamed of. It's something that is totally normal. And I think that another way that our vending machines will help students is the cost. Usually to go off campus to a CVS or a Walgreens, the Plan B will cost students upwards of $50, which could be pretty pricey for students here at Northeastern. We hope that our pill would be subsidized by the university and students can only pay $8.
Well, I think the Boston University vending machine, which has the Plan B contraceptive pill, that pill is $7.25. So as you said, schools can make them less expensive. There's also the matter of time. You only have 72 hours to make this decision.
Yes, of course. So by having this vending machine available to students, there's no potential wait time to get to a prescription. It'll be right on campus. Students can walk not even 5 minutes to get there and make the safest option for them.
This does keep it private in that students, you know, don't have to go to a healthcare provider for whatever stigma they might see in doing that. But then some argue that that's actually part of the problem, that somebody who has had unprotected sex might be the person who needs to see a medical professional, could see a doctor and get contraception, could test for STDs, could maybe get some help if they were coerced into sex or raped, and that all of that would not be uncovered if she went to a vending machine.
You're definitely right about that. There are some hesitancies there that medical providers do have really good advice and are really great resources. But at the end of the day, it can take weeks to even months to get an appointment with these individuals. And with this vending machine, we have an option.
Well, and I'm thinking another benefit might be that students at any school who come from a state that is limiting reproductive rights might feel more comfortable if they had some from the vending machine to bring home with them.
Yes, and it might even entice people to come to Northeastern if they see Northeastern as a champion for reproductive justice.
That's Northeastern University student Alexandra Nieto, a member of Northeastern University's Sexual Health Advocacy Resources and Education Group, or SHARE, and they're pushing to get Plan B contraception pills in vending machines at the school. Alexandra, thank you so much for talking to us about it.
Thank you.
More than 2 years and at least a dozen major mutations since the COVID-19 pandemic began, the novel coronavirus is still the world's biggest medical headline grabber. But according to many physicians and public health researchers, it's not humanity's biggest medical challenge. That title is reserved for antibiotic-resistant bacteria, or superbugs. The infections they cause now kill more than 1 million people a year, and a new analysis from the CDC says that the pandemic has caused them to surge in hospitals after several years of decline. Dr. Chris Murray is chair of Health Metrics Sciences at the University of Washington. His study on superbugs was published in The Lancet in January. Dr. Murray, welcome.
Happy to be here.
We're going to talk about the new CDC analysis, which just came out recently, in a minute. But before we do that, let's talk about why it matters. I mean, just remind people, we have lived with antibiotics now for several generations. What do they do, and what was the world like before them?
Well, antibiotics help us tackle bacterial infections that in many cases we would otherwise not be able to overcome. And so, you know, the advent of antibiotics has led to a huge decrease in death rates from things like pneumonia. And so if we don't have antibiotics that work, we run the risk of going back to the old days when the death rates from those conditions were really quite high.
Right. Super high. And we know that the more antibiotics are used, whether in medicine or in agriculture, and people take them when they don't need to take them, the more they do this, the more bacteria learns how to mutate and not respond to the antibiotics.
That's right. When you give people antibiotics and then a mutation comes along in a bacteria that allows it to be resistant to that antibiotic, the more we use antibiotics, the more those types of mutations will spread and then come back to infect us with a nasty, resistant bacteria.
Yeah. Well, and this brings us to COVID-19. COVID is a virus. Antibiotics are for bacteria-caused illnesses. But in the beginning of the pandemic, it was so new. We didn't know what we were seeing when people came into hospitals so violently ill. And a lot of people were given antibiotics even though they had COVID.
Well, there's a good reason for that, which is if you go back, for example, to the Spanish flu, a lot of people who died from the Spanish flu, you know, 100 years ago, actually died from a secondary bacterial infection in the lungs. And so physicians have always been concerned that viral infections that affect the lungs can lead to you having a secondary infection with a bacteria that actually may be the pathway to death. And so it's not surprising that as in the beginning, and still today, in some cases, there's a real concern about bacteria and led to a lot of antibiotic use.
Yeah. Well, we're reading that in between March and October of 2020, 80% of COVID patients were being given antibiotics. But then also, because COVID required things like people being on ventilators and different procedures that might break the skin, that was another way that bacteria could grow?
Well, when people are very sick in hospital, you know, in the ICU or in, you know, high-intensity care, it is very common to get hospital-acquired infections for all sorts of mechanisms, you know, especially those that are, let's say, on mechanical ventilation. That's a common outcome. And frequently, they get infected with the bacteria that are present in an environment where lots and lots of antibiotics are being used. In other words, often it's a drug-resistant bacteria.
Yeah. What can doctors do that maybe they're not doing, and what can we all do?
First and foremost is to make sure that the research and development pipeline is continuing to produce new antibiotics so we can keep ahead of this sort of arms race with the bacteria. But then we can decrease the likelihood of the spread of these drug-resistant bacteria by avoiding inappropriate use, you know, only use antibiotics when they're really going to help the patient. And of course, all efforts to reduce the risk of transmission of these drug-resistant bacteria, you know, infection control in hospitals, avoiding contact when patients do have drug-resistant bacteria.
Wash your hands.
Wash your hands. All those measures that make up good infection control. And then just decreasing the amount of infection that's out there through things like vaccination for, let's say, the pneumococcus or other bacteria.
Do you think we're headed in the right direction coming out of the pandemic, having learned a lesson about creating antibiotic-resistant bacteria? Or do you worry that we could be headed back there again at some point?
We suspect that globally, deaths from antimicrobial resistance are on the way up. In our analysis of all the data that's out there for drug resistance, it turns out much to our and pretty much everyone in the field's surprise, deaths from antimicrobial resistance are highest in Africa. And we all thought before that they would be highest in the US and Europe and Australia and New Zealand, where antibiotic use is highest. But because there's so much more infection in low and middle income countries, even though the percent of infections due to resistance are a little bit lower, the number of people dying from AMR is actually greatest in the least resourced parts of the world. So this is a problem that we think will get worse in the future and really requires, you know, a concerted effort now to avoid being in that situation where we may not have effective antibiotics to deal with some of the more common pathogens that are out there. And of course, it's tied up very closely with this question of future pandemics emerging, because the same surveillance systems that will help us track the emergence of a new pathogen can also help us track the emergence of or spread of drug resistance.
That's Dr. Chris Murray from the University of Washington talking about the CDC's new findings of rising antibiotic-resistant infections in hospitals. And they tie it back to the height of the pandemic. Dr. Murray, thank you so much. Lots to think about.
Thanks very much for your time.
In Gaza, a ceasefire is still holding after the most violent weekend since the devastating 11-day war last year between Israel and Hamas. The weekend's fighting between Israeli forces and Islamic Jihad killed at least 44 Palestinians and wounded more than 300 people. Let's get an update on the situation with Emily Rose from the Associated Press. She's in Jerusalem. Hi, Emily.
Hi. Tell us. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. Tell us the situation now in Gaza. Has the ceasefire held?
Yes, it looks like the ceasefire is holding. As a very late Sunday night, it went into effect. And very quickly after, we saw the resumption of regular activity over that border, including the opening of the crossings along the Gaza border that allow humanitarian aid to enter the Gaza Strip. And we also saw all the military directives that were given to those Israeli civilians in those communities along that border lifted. So it seems as though life is resuming, though, of course, the fear among those civilians on both sides of this conflict still lingers, and that is something that takes quite a while, if at any time, to dissipate.
Yeah. Was there any significance to the timing of the fighting over the weekend?
So the stated purpose that the Israeli military gave for the launching of this strike, and I'll remind everyone that it was a preemptive strike taken by the Israeli military, was that there was credible evidence that there was a threat coming from the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, that's a militant group in the Gaza Strip, that they were readying to harm Israeli civilians. And here I have to mention that the Associated Press in Jerusalem has been requesting empirical evidence for that credible threat, that claim of that credible threat, and as of the recording of this conversation, we've yet to receive any credible empirical evidence. They do say that that was the claim and that was the reason for that preemptive strike.
I see. It appears that this was a rare situation in which the ruling Hamas organization in Palestinian-controlled Gaza actually sat on the sidelines of the fighting. Why did they stay out of it?
Yes, Jane, for those of us watching this over here, that really does appear to be the paradigm shift in this conflict, this ongoing escalation and conflict between Israel and militants in the Gaza Strip. And when I've spoken to senior Israeli former military and intelligence officials, they explained to me that at this point, Hamas has economic interests that they didn't want to tamper with. And if they got involved, that would really derail a lot of the progress, the economic progress that they've made over the course of this year, which I'll remind everyone everyone was relatively peaceful. And then another aspect they pointed out to me was that Hamas is looking to expand control in the West Bank, and they wanted to further that cause. And so they decided to stay out of it this round. And needless to say that they have a much higher arsenal, they have much higher level of weaponry. And so if they had gotten involved, it would have been far more lethal and far more deadly conflict that could have gone on for much longer as well. Mm.
So what is the relationship, if this is a paradigm shift, what is the relationship at the moment between the Israeli government and Hamas?
Well, on the face of it, Israel still maintains that Hamas is a terror organization. But I will point you to one interesting point here, and that is that Israel allowed 20,000 work permits for Gazan workers to work within Israeli territory. And that really does mark a shift, because it means that those permits do need to require some kind of deal with Hamas to sign off on those. I'm looking now at comprehensive studies that are measuring the economic benefits or impacts of that. And so that marks a shift in the actual relationship between Israel and Hamas. It isn't, by any stretch of the imagination, an outward recognition of Hamas as a sovereign or as a government, but it is some kind of nod to the fact that they do have control over the Gaza Strip in the sense that they are signing those work permits.
And in our last 10 seconds, in Israel, this is being seen as a victory, no?
Yes, and Israeli caretaker Prime Minister Yair Lapid will be running for elections. He wants to get reelected November 1st. He's never been properly elected. He wants to see himself elected. And so this was a real test for him if he can manage the country under fire.
Emily Rose for the Associated Press in Jerusalem. Emily, thank you.
If you've just had it with canceled airline flights messing with your summer plans, then this might be of interest. Two Democrats in Congress want to make airlines more accountable for certain kinds of last-minute cancellations. For instance, when they offer flights, even when they know they don't have enough staff to fly them. This is the latest of a flurry of proposals to give consumers more protection when things go wrong. Seth Kaplan is Here and Now's transportation analyst. Hi, Seth.
Hi, Robin.
So these are the representatives, Jan Schakowsky and David Cicilline. They're upset about, let's call them preventable cancellations. Really, how much does that happen and can be proven, and what exactly are they proposing?
Those words can be proven, right? And that's the tricky part here. A lot of times when a flight cancels, it's kind of a confluence of issues. And I know I've had those situations where an airline has said to me, oh, it's the weather. And which of course they're not responsible for. And I said, well, yeah, there was weather, but there was also all these other things that maybe could have been prevented. So that's the tough part. But there's no question that right now, some number of these cancellations, and a non-zero number, are down to these staffing issues.
Yeah. Well, and what, if anything, are they proposing that can help?
Well, they're proposing enforceable fines, for example, among other things. And this is all part of several different proposals that would also give passengers, for example, the right to, when it's the airline's fault, not just maybe a voucher that eventually expires. And I don't know about you, but I've sometimes had those expire sitting in a drawer before I could use them. But instead, either a voucher that doesn't expire, or perhaps even a cash refund. You know, I've been in that situation where I get a voucher and I think to myself, well, the last thing I want is to fly that airline again after that experience, right? And so perhaps even a cash refund, depending on which pieces of these legislation ultimately see the light of day.
Well, tell us about more pieces. We recently had an experience, I will not name the airline, in which we booked it several times with several different, you know, people, on the phone because there was a newborn involved, and the mother with the newborn gets to airport and no sign of the newborn on the booking, even though we did it, you know, so many times. So what else might airlines be punished for in this proposal?
Yeah, well, right now they're looking at these staffing issues, right? So it would be if they should have known, and if it turns out to be that, then big, rather meaningful fines. And we've seen this in the past where it does alter airline behavior. The tarmac delays, for example, that's an example, Rob, you might remember, people stuck on planes away from the gate for many hours. Now, that still happens, but it happens a lot less then before airlines could be fined literally millions of dollars for one incident of that. And so that's the hope here by these lawmakers. Airlines say, look, this is all usually unpredictable, that they do cancel flights ahead of time, which they are in fact doing by the thousands right now in future months. They're trying to meet demand, and sometimes it just doesn't work out.
Well, and airlines are profitable and doing better than even they expected as they're canceling flights and can't seem to hire enough people. So there's, assuming going to be, in the few seconds we have, a lot more examination of this.
Exactly. With falling fuel prices, less demand or less supply than there is demand, pushing fares up. Airlines are doing surprisingly well despite the mess.
Yeah. Seth Kaplan here now as transportation analyst. Seth, thank you so much. We will continue to follow this.
You got it, Robin. Thank you.
Minnesota Progressive Democrat Ilhan Omar narrowly survived her congressional primary last night. That was one surprise in primaries in four states yesterday. Another incumbent, the Republican Jamie Herrera Butler of Washington State, lost her primary, one of 10 House Republicans who voted to impeach President Trump.
And a day after the FBI executed a search warrant at the former president's home in Florida, Trump's pick for governor of Wisconsin, Tim Michels, won. Yesterday, Michels tweeted about the search, quote, "If the federal government can do this to a former president, imagine what they can do to you," end quote. Michels has not ruled out trying to overturn the 2020 election results in the state.
So there's lots of interest in Wisconsin. So let's convene two Wisconsin-based political strategists. Bill McCoshin is the Republican. Hi, Bill.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. And Scott, and you would seem to be too. We'll find out. And Scott Ross is the Democrat. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Robin. Hi, Jane.
And Tim, Tim Michels is a construction magnate. He won over the Republicans' former Lieutenant Governor Rebecca Clayfish. That was the choice of the Republican political strategist and former Vice President Mike Pence. So it was another Pence-Trump matchup there, another election denier-ish matchup. Clayfish says the last election can't be overturned. Michael said he'd explore it. Bill, start with you. What does this tell you about your party in the state?
Well, it tells me Donald Trump's brand is still very strong, not just in Wisconsin, but across the country. You're listening to the lead into this, another one of the folks who voted to impeach him on the Republican side went down in a primary last night in the state of Washington. So his brand is very, very strong here. I think it was instrumental in Michels quickly closing the gap with Rebecca Clayfish, who had been running for governor for 2 years prior to Michels getting in. But then ultimately, I think Michels' message, Robin and Jane, resonated with people. They liked the idea he was an outsider. I think that had as much to do with his victory last night as the endorsement from Trump. People want something different. He's an outsider. He's a businessman. He's a veteran. He's an Army Ranger. So I think those two things combined are why Tim Michels won handily last night.
Scott, are you listening to this and thinking he is avoiding saying Trump?
Well, I think that, Trump's brand is strong in the state of Wisconsin, but he had a split decision last night. Yes, Tim Michels got across the finish line first, but we had a high-profile attorney general race, and Trump, the candidate who won was not a Trumper, and Trump went against our assembly speaker, our Republican assembly speaker, and our assembly speaker won his primary election last night. You know, the fact is, it is Trump's party, and that bodes poorly for Tim Michels, because he's, you know, beholden to the Trump policies, the bad Trump brand, the way that Trump has lost voters throughout the suburbs of Wisconsin. And he is, you know, part and parcel of what the Republican Party is right now in the state of Wisconsin, which is the big lie, anti-choice, and, you know, anti-investment in things like education and infrastructure.
Well, Tim Michels thanked Donald Trump in his acceptance speech, and then he took aim at Democrats. Here he is.
Standing up for the hardworking people of Wisconsin, they've been left behind by the Democratic Party that just wants to focus on the social issues. From my first day in office to my very last day as governor, jobs and the economy are going to be my number one priority.
Bill, I presume the social issues he's talking about are abortion rights, no?
Well, it's one of them, right? So with the Dobbs decision, abortion is now a state issue, not a federal issue. And we saw that play out in Kansas just a week ago. You know, we have a law on the books here in the state of Wisconsin. Tim Michaels has said he supports that law. Our current governor, Tony Evers, has said he would overturn that law if he could. I mean, I think your listeners are all smart enough to know that that would have to go through the legislature for a governor to sign. A governor can't do that by executive order. You know, but I think what Michaels is talking about is social issues more like critical race theory and things like, you know, the identity politics. We're going to get away from that. We're going to focus on bread and butter issues that people talk about at their kitchen table every night. The economy, inflation, jobs, good schools, you know, the rising crime. What are we going to do to lower the crime, not only in our largest city of Milwaukee, but in some of our other major cities like Madison, Kenosha, Racine? So I think Michaels will focus on economic issues primarily, in part because that's what voters are focused on right now.
Well, I want to ask Go ahead, Scott.
I'm sorry, I was going to say the point is that forcing a woman to bear a child she doesn't want to have is an economic issue. And when it comes to Tim Michaels, he does support that pre-Civil War abortion ban, which does not include any exceptions for rape or incest. And Michaels has even said that, quote unquote, it's not unreasonable, end quote, for politicians, Republican politicians, to force a pregnant rape victim to give birth. Abortion is on the ballot this fall in Wisconsin because abortion is an economic issue, it is a fairness issue, and it is a healthcare issue. And Republicans are going to try and run from that as much as they possibly can because they are hemorrhaging suburban women voters over this.
Well, that's Scott Ross, the Democratic strategist, and Bill McCoshin, the Republican. I think I said Kosh, and I know Oshkosh.
Yep,
Oshkosh, yep. So it should be Kosh. But I want to ask you both, what do you think has been the impact of the FBI's search of Trump's Florida estate, Mar-a-Lago? Bill, start with you.
Well, listen, we had a record turnout on the Republican side yesterday. There was almost 700,000 primary voters. The closest we've ever come to that before was in 2010, 12 years ago, when we had 625,000 votes. So, you know, Republicans are jazzed up. Part of the reason for that, Robin and Jane, I think, is what happened at Mar-a-Lago. I think people say to themselves, holy smokes, if that can happen to a president, you know, what are they going to do with those 87,000 new IRS agents that are about to be signed into law, right? Those IRS agents are coming for me next. Mm-hmm. And you're going to hear Michaels talk about that on the trail. And frankly, Evers' numbers here are good. Our current governor, Tony Evers, his numbers are decent. They're right side up. They're net positive. But Biden's numbers are net negative here. And so you will hear references to the president about the direction of the economy. And, you know, frankly, I think bread and butter economic issues are what's going to decide this election. I'm not saying abortion won't be an issue. I think it will be. But Tim Michaels has a faith-based position that I think is, you know, even if people disagree with him, I think they'll appreciate and respect where he comes from on that.
Scott?
Well, I'd say this is that, you know, a president withholding, you know, documents and a violation of the Presidential Records Act is a serious offense. And I would go back to Bill, you know, saying earlier that crime is going to be on, you know, crime is one of the issues that Democrats face a challenge with. And literally every Republican elected official is saying that the laws do not apply to Donald Trump because they've been adjudicated against him. And I would say this in terms of, you know, the IRS agents and the, you know, claim that this is somehow an overreach because we expect the former president to be held to the same standards that every other president comes to when it comes to classified documents. I saw a note on social media that I think best summed it up when they said, you know, Fox News seemed to be prepared for this the way that the BBC is prepared for Queen Elizabeth's passing. The fact is that Donald Trump may have broken the law and he is being held accountable, and there is nothing wrong with him having to serve to put up documents about that to say what it, you know, what it is that they were searching for. Bring out the search warrant if you think you've been aggrieved.
Let's back up a little bit and remind everyone that Joe Biden won Wisconsin in 2020 by 21,000 votes. Trump won over Hillary Clinton by 22,000 votes in 2016. I mean, Michaels refuses to rule out signing a law to overturn the 2020 election. Will independent or swing voters be alarmed by that, Bill?
I think you're gonna see over the course of the next 89 days what Michaels is gonna tell voters is, if you want more election integrity, Republicans who control both houses of the legislature in the state of Wisconsin have already passed a suite of bills that would do just that. Governor Evers has vetoed those bills two times. Governor Michaels, should he be elected, will sign those bills in his first 2 weeks in office. So the best thing we can do to ensure election integrity here in the state of Wisconsin is not to look backwards. It's to look forward and to fix the laws that are broken.
We're going to have to go real quick. Scott, give us in 15 seconds your thoughts.
The Republicans want to keep people from being able to exercise the right to vote. It is simple as that. And, you know, they'll be motivated to make sure they get out to the polls. We'll be getting everybody out to the polls in November.
You can tell they do this for a living. Yeah. Bill McCutcheon, the Republican strategist, Scott Ross, the Democrat, taking a look at what happened in Wisconsin primaries yesterday. Guys, thanks so much.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you very much.
Thanks to you both.
As record heat waves blanket the world, we want to begin a look at a global movement to make air conditioning a human right. We know your first thought might be, but air conditioners increase electricity use and the emissions that are causing climate change? Yes, but there are ways to be greener about cooling off, and there is definitely a deadly inequity. In the hottest and often poorest regions in the world, just 12% of people have AC compared to 90% in the U.S. Dr. Morgan Bazilian from the Colorado School of Mines has been looking into air conditioning as a universal right. And Dr. Bazilian, we know it's deadly. I mean, 1,500 people in one heat wave in Britain died. But heat waves also mean people can't work.
Yeah, that's right, Robin. Look, the most air conditioning units are in residents in people's homes, and that's to protect them in their homes from the heat waves. But the heat waves themselves are having huge economic effects and public health effects on people's ability to work and therefore on their economy's ability to thrive. And so those have further knock-on effects that are not just public health.
Yeah. And so talk about the biggest concern, that if you do provide air conditioning, and there is a move to provide air conditioning to countries like India, then you increase the problem, which is the global warming. We know you and others are talking about more efficient cooling technology. What are you looking at?
If you look at an issue where you're going to want to increase the energy demand in developing countries, then we have to go back to the fundamentals of how we design energy systems and how we focus.
You talk about it's an opportunity now to build cleaner and more equal energy systems. For instance, solar power generation is perfect for some of these countries where peak solar is also peak heat, when they can be using ACs that are purely solar driven, planting more trees. I mean, this is an opportunity to think of ways to bring not just equity, but more efficiency.
I think that's right, Robin. And what we've seen is we don't have to focus only on supply side economic policies. What we really can do is go back to the things we've known work for the last 50, 60 years, which are focus on demand and efficiency. And as an example, in the AC market, there are companies like Carrier in the United States that are making AC units three times more efficient. So not a matter of 10 or 20%, but three times more efficient than the current market. So the technology is absolutely here, and the technology is not the obstacle to getting these things out.
Well,
then we have to deal with the messy issues of politics and policy.
Well, I was just going to ask, who does this? Who implements this policy? And by the way, you talk about a more efficient AC from Carrier. One of the problems, critics say, is that American companies have been dumping old, inefficient air conditioners on poorer countries, as if they can check that off their list. That needs to stop, too. But who mandates this?
At the level of policy, the national and local governments are the key players. At the level of getting this onto the priority attention of decision makers, then multilateral organizations like the United Nations can have an important role. And as an example, the UN already has several initiatives focused on AC cooling, as well as the type of refrigerants used in AC units. And those are ongoing. But at the level of making standards, efficiency standards, and non-dumping practices, as you mentioned, that is going to have to be at the national level to be enforceable and robust.
Well, here in the U.S., there are already laws about landlords, building owners having to provide heat to tenants in winter in some parts of the U.S. But it's varied across the country as to whether or not states will require landlords to provide AC. Some states do, some states don't. We're seeing reports of a woman dying in her apartment in Portland, Oregon, or a restaurant here in Boston whose new landlord cut off the air conditioning to the restaurant. Do you think that it ought to be required by law here in the U.S.?
Well, certainly in some jurisdictions, in the same place where you traditionally may require heat, you're now going to have to put in place regulations to require cooling in some parts of the country. And that's for the same exact reasons you would have to provide heat. And so that's a matter of equity and justice. And I would say that, you know, under this administration, the kind of policies to look at what is sometimes called energy justice, in other words, providing energy services for those who need them the most, has been very active. And in fact, aspects of that are part of that new Inflation Reduction Act. And so I think you're going to see a sort of strong movement under this administration to make sure that things like cooling become as mandatory as heating in some places.
Yeah. Dr. Morgan Bazilian, I think it's time to walk the dog.
Yeah, sorry about that.
No, that's okay. We really appreciate your time. You're director there of the Colorado School of Mines Payne Institute. We thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on, Robin.
And we're going to continue to cover this story, energy justice and cooling equity. And we'll have more stories down the road, Here and Now. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Jane Clayson. This is Here and Now.